With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going. You're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the Publisher Fight. It's time for the Publisher Fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that New England power.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the Editor-in-Chief at Video Week, and this week's guest is Tess Alps. Tess is the Chair at Thinkbox. They're the UK TV industry's marketing body. They're highly effective at what they do, and Tess was the original founder, and she's soon stepping down as Chair. So at New Video Frontiers, we decided to do an exit interview with Tess. Now, we did one of these last year with Jamie West as he was leaving Sky, and the idea is to look back at the person's career, what they achieved, and for it to be a more lighthearted, probably more personal conversation, looking back at what they've achieved. I think Tess would be on my top 10 people I would invite to my sort of dream industry dinner party. She's very witty, insightful, and I think she's been a trailblazer for a lot of women in the industry. I know a lot of our team, many of whom are female, when they're watching this interview, the sort of group chat lit up with some of the younger women in our team feeling very inspired and feeling that, you know, Tess was very much a legend, which is how I think most people would describe her. Just a little bit of housekeeping from us. We have NVF Roadmap. This is an event which looks ahead at the coming year. Because of the, we're trying to make keep our digital events a little bit shorter from here on in. Shorter, more impactful, and sort of being able to sort of focus the attention of the audience a little bit more. So on January 21st, we're going to be doing NVF Roadmap, focusing only on CTV this year. The idea is to sort of look at the challenges and opportunities ahead in the coming year. We think that January is a good time for that, when people are in the mindset of looking ahead at what they're confronted with. I think it's fair to say we've got a challenging year ahead of us in 2021. But there's also lots to be optimistic and excited about, and we think the event will reflect that. We'll be announcing speakers in a couple of weeks, but if you'd like to register, you can do so on the New Video Frontiers website. So it's just www.newvideofrontiers.com. Okay, so now I'll cross over to my chat with Tess. This was a really fun interview for me to do, and yeah, I hope you really enjoy it too. You know, I think most people know you and associate you with Thinkbox. I think people have been around the industry longer. You had plenty of high profile before that. So could you just tell us a little bit about your career to date coming up to Thinkbox?
Okay, Vinny. Well, I actually started in advertising in 1977. Can you believe?
You're always born?
Completely by accident. Didn't know what I was getting into. I do think I arrived as a temporary filing clerk at ATV. Having worked in theatre and education for a while. And it wasn't until about the mid-80s, I didn't really think I liked advertising very much or approved of it even, because I was a classic hippie. But I sort of got moved from filing into advertising sales at ATV, got on very quickly, moved to different TV companies, ended up being an ITV sales director in the late 80s, which was... I wasn't the first woman, actually, but the first woman was somebody I worked for, but she only lasted 9 months before she married somebody, went off to Antigua. So I think I was the first probably fully functioning female ITV sales director. And then I decided it was a bit boring, really, and that I probably ought to go off and learn how to do this advertising media thing properly. So I joined my friends, Patterson, Horswell and Durden at PhD, which had been set up in 1990, a small independent media agency founded with the model, the exact opposite, if you like, of Zenith, which was founded at the same time. Zenith was founded around size and volume and leverage. PhD's principle was about thinking and planning and strategy, and that appealed to me hugely. And so I arrived in 92 and I spent 13 years at PhD learning about All Media, doing different directorships. For 3 years, I was in charge of their internet media division. We were the first media agency to install a search team, for instance. And for a while I ran Drum, so content and sponsorships. So it was an absolutely brilliant and fun thing to do. I ended up as the chair of the PhD group in the UK. And in my 50s, by now, I was thinking I probably ought to retire and just bugger off and let other people run it. When I got a call from the TV industry, I think by then the IAB was 10 years old. And I had been one of the people from media agencies nagging them, saying, you know, why don't you counter this nonsense that's, I've just seen Google write a report. It's full of nonsense. And why isn't anybody in the TV industry, you know, rebutting this or coming up with the facts? Anyway, finally, they rang me and said, you know, you're such a pain in the ass. Would you like to come and do it? And to be honest, a lot of people thought I was mad. Why would I take on this basket case that was TV? But because I cared enormously about it, it's not the only medium I care about. I care about all sorts of things. But I thought it was probably the most misrepresented medium at that time, and had an enormously important and positive role commercially and culturally. And it needed a champion. And so, you can never do more than at the very start of this thing, going around all the TV companies saying, yeah, you've got to give me quite a few million quid or I'm not going to do it. And you've got to let me do it like this. Or you can fire me if I don't produce any results. And they were absolutely brilliant and came up with the money and have been hugely supportive ever since. And so that's 14 and a half years ago now. So I finally decided, you know, it's, I can honestly say the Thinkbox team is the best in the world of any organisation of its type. I'm not, it's not just bullshit. They are absolutely brilliant and much admired around the world. And there have been Thinkbox-like organisations set up around the world, even in the States now, that in Canada and Australia and New Zealand, South Africa. And we have also been the driving force behind something called the Global TV Group. So with ECTA, the European group that represents TV companies, being a big participant and a big driver of it. But it's wonderful to see the global TV industry get together because they need to act globally in the face of very large global competition. So that's it. So I'm retiring at the end of the year, but I will spend another 3 years at the ASA on the council, trying to make ads better and better regulated.
I was mentioned to Lindsay on our, when we did our podcast together, that I often hear people, particularly from the US, speaking very enviously about Thinkbox and the data they put out, the way you sort of argue TV's case. I think they, a lot of the people in the US, I think, I know they do have equivalents, but they sort of, they do feel that Thinkbox is.
I think when we set up, they had something called the TVB, the TV Bureau, and the CAB, which is the Cable Advertising Bureau. So unfortunately, they spent a lot of time just fighting against each other when advertisers don't think of cable versus, you know, free-to-air. Consumers might, but for an advertising decision, really, you need to collaborate. And so they have finally come together and produced something called the Video Advertising Bureau in the States. And Sean Cunningham, who runs that. I mean, I wish they hadn't called it the Video Advertising Bureau, but never mind. They mean TV. They mean professionally made video content. So we're all getting our act together.
So as you already mentioned, you know, over the years, Thinkbox has been no stranger to a bit of argy-bargy with the tech companies and the social networks, YouTube, I think, particularly over the years. I mean, how would you describe that relationship? Has it evolved at all over the years, or do you feel that there's an ongoing tension there?
I think we have a sort of zero tolerance policy in terms of people spreading false or fake news, if you like, post-truth TV. And Google 10 years ago was probably a big source of it. I have to say, I think Google is much reformed in that sense. I don't think they put out a lot of bullshit. And also, people liked to characterise me particularly, but Think Box as being anti-internet, which is so far from the truth. We are passionate believers in the internet as a technology. It's a wonderful, wondrous, transforming technology. We just don't like it to be abused, and we just don't like people, any company, to say that they sort of own it, they have the rights to it. I think even I look back at some of the things I said in 2006 when I joined Thinkbox or set up Thinkbox. And I'm pleased to say I said back then, please can we stop this internet versus TV nonsense? A, they're not equivalents. The internet is a technology, and it could be and will be increasingly a distribution technology for TV. So, you know, stop comparing them. Actually, internet plus TV will be amazing. And TV advertising plus various forms of internet media, like search, like email, like social media, are a very powerful combination. And we've done various research projects with, say, the IAB, with Twitter. So it's very wrong to characterize Thinkbox as anti-internet. But like, you know, we like driving, but we don't like drunk driving. So that's all. So I think we're very happy. I am very happy, and Lindsay too, to get on a stage and tell it like it is. And I think still, although I see this week that Facebook has decided to remove Holocaust deniers. You think, what took you so long? But there are quite a lot of other harms out there. I think what we find pretty hard to take in the TV world, when every bit of content is not only vetted before it goes out on air or is streamed, it is also paid for. And somehow we find it difficult that some social media companies find that very hard to do. And I need to be careful in terms of my ASA role, but I think we would, even if they aren't prepared to vet all content, and they would say they do vet some content, they have various AI machine learning techniques that spot various things, but it seems to me a lot of bad content gets through and does a lot of harm before it gets removed. But when it comes to advertising, I absolutely can't understand why advertising in social media platforms can't be pre-vetted, because it's being paid for. There's a sum of money there that they can, you know, help to pay for this process. It's a cost of doing good business, in my opinion. So yes, we still would probably have a go at them about that, but things are getting a lot better. I think YouTube is miles better than it was. I've been watching a fair bit of YouTube on my 65-inch television screen during lockdown. There's a lot of good TV on YouTube. Also a lot of other stuff that I wouldn't want to watch. So TV will use that platform and other platforms as it always has, to be honest.
Just with your ASA hat on, is there, we're seeing a movement across the industry, we're seeing groups like Conscious Advertising Network spring up, and you know they're trying to sort of introduce some more of a stronger ethical backbone on the advertiser side. In sort of choosing where their money is spent. Is there scope for the ASA to maybe hold advertisers a bit more accountable for where their ads run as well? Or is that...
That's really not the remit of the ASA. Mm. That's very much Ofcom's position. And I mean, Ofcom only governs at the moment the content for radio and TV. And video sharing platforms, so various online outlets. It's not the ASA's job to monitor content, no.
Yep.
But it does govern all forms of advertising, including what advertisers say on websites. But obviously it acts only when they get a complaint. And that's not true, actually. The ASA is increasingly trying to be proactive and heading off problems like, for instance, with influencers, secondary ticketing. They taken on various campaigns, gender stereotyping. And given this is the advertising industry paying for the ASA, it's a completely self-funded system. We need all advertisers to agree to pay in order to make sure advertising retains its quality. We have problems, as the Advertising Association's research has proved, with declining levels of trust in all advertising. And one can't help but think poor quality advertising online is part of that problem. So it's for all advertisers to agree to fund the ASA in order to maintain people's trust in advertising, because only trusted advertising works. So it's a complicated issue.
Yeah, it is. It always is, trying to align all these different pieces.
Yeah.
So looking back over the years, what would you regard as your proudest professional achievement? I'm hoping that there's a story about a bar fight with a Google executive, but you might want to go for something more noble.
Well, I don't know. I suppose I don't think of my career like that. I am very proud of having set up Thinkbox. I think that was, in terms of me individually making something happen, I suppose that's I'm proud of deciding to do it in my mid-50s, if you like, because one could easily have just sloped off to the Chilterns and grown more cabbages. So it took a lot, and the getting the TV industry behind us, getting the money, getting, you know, was a considerable feat. And, you know, it takes a while before it shows any results, but they stayed with us. And now I like to think they wouldn't ever dream of not supporting something like Thinkbox. And I also, I mean, in 2018, I got a medal. I'm not really into medals and honours and things like that. But I was very, very happy to receive a medal from the Advertising Association called the Macintosh Medal, which is the highest honour that the advertising industry awards. And it's not just for professional, it's for your personal contribution. So I like to think I've been a good advertising citizen, if you like,
yeah,
doing various things beyond my day job. So.
Yeah. And more interestingly, what do you regret? What would you have done differently if you could do it all over again?
I spent 9 years not really knowing what the fuck I was doing, not really learning properly, thinking I was going to go off and go back and be an actress or whatever. So probably learning more, but also at a much earlier age, not wanting to be liked so much. I think that's a real trap for people, possibly more women than men, is just wanting to be liked. So only when I got into my hard-boiled 40s, 50s, I thought, oh, do you know what, I don't give a damn. I'm just going to say it anyway. So I spent too long trying to be liked, and I think a lot of people do that.
It's one of the nice sides of getting older, I think, is that, yeah, being less dependent on people's perceptions of you. Yeah. So who over the years do you think has had the most positive impact on you? Is there any individuals that stand out as?
Well, obviously, Paterson, Horswell and Durden were pretty influential. I mean, to go to a place with three, they set the model of three very different people, equal status partners. So I love that idea of not having a pyramid that was one person necessarily at the top. I actually think most great organizations are truly built from a team. So, I mean, I learnt lots from them and I love them all still. But I suppose the single person is a guy called Craig Pearman, who perhaps very few people will remember. He actually died, I think, in 96. But he was a legend at London Weekend Television. Sort of number two to Ron Miller, who probably people might have heard of. But he is the person who, he appointed me as a sales director when nobody else was appointing women into those roles. And he also taught me about customers, listening to customers, That you can only ever make a great sale if you listen properly to customers and then give them something they need, not just that you want to flog them. Actually being a great, and that's the way that helped me be proud of being a salesperson. That actually you have, if you believe in the thing you've got to sell and you've listened to that, to your customer, you know what they need, then you're doing them a favor. And I think I certainly feel that now, that everything we tell, you know, advertisers and agencies, I feel is A, absolutely the truth. And I feel they need to know those things. So I'm never embarrassed to be a salesperson.
Yeah, I think that was something that I had to reconcile in my own mind. I think starting my own business, the sales side was the part. I sort of imagined that maybe you were supposed to trick people in some way into buying something. And then I think...
Could never do that.
No.
It's short-lived.
Exactly.
What scammers do. Scammers and conmen.
Yeah.
That's not the way to build a sales career.
I think once you start to believe in what you're selling and realize, oh, this does have value and does work, then yeah, it sort of falls into place. And you can look people in the eye and you possibly become a more effective salesperson. I'm not sure you do meet the occasional, I think they're often called white boys, where they seem to get away with murder and make a fortune. So I don't know. Sometimes I do wonder if there's other more Machiavellian types who manage to play the system and get away with it somehow. But I think when it's your own business, I wouldn't want it that way.
Can they sleep and can they live with themselves, Vinny?
I think they'd sleep.
There's more to life than being rich.
Very much so. Very much so. You've served, I mean, you mentioned about being a sales director. I mean, I think even the stories I've heard about, you know, the culture, the sales culture often within the TV world and within the national press, even in the 2000s, it could be an exceptionally macho, aggressive, yeah, often sometimes bullying atmosphere. What was your experience of it as being a female sales director? And, you know, was it like that? Was it elbows out?
I think it was quite a masculine culture. Maybe I was just lucky that I worked for Harry Turner at Westwood Television, who had promoted a female sales director, and Craig himself. And in terms of, I was never one of the boys. I never played golf. I didn't drink a lot. But equally, I wasn't sort of girly, whatever that means. Obviously, I wasn't very girly. I was just sort of, I don't know, I didn't think too hard about it. I didn't do any bullying, I don't think. One of the things I do regret is I definitely saw sexual harassment take place and didn't speak up enough, that, you know, before I got brave enough to be unliked. I wish I'd been prepared to be disliked back then and support and going to help people I saw being groped or whatever, strong-armed into hotel rooms and whatever. So I was very pleased in 2017 to start the industry's initiative called Time 2, which you might have heard about.
Yes, have, yeah.
To combat sexual harassment. Yeah. And it's still terrifyingly prevalent. Even, you know, it's a collaboration between the Advertising Association, NABS, and WACL, and they do regular studies, sort of sweeps, to see what's happening. And I'm afraid to say it's happening as much, perhaps not quite as much, as it did. So I think there's been some fantastic communications and training initiatives to try and help companies combat that. There's a lot for companies to do, isn't there, with diversity and inclusion, but sexual harassment absolutely has to be part of good management. And it's mainly women who suffer it, but not entirely. Mm. Some men get sexually harassed by women and men, and we can't let it happen. It's so humiliating. It absolutely destroys people's self-confidence.
I remember seeing a board from, it might have been one of your organization's events, but there was just people had put different notes telling all personal anecdotes, and it was just the women in the room. This wasn't a, you know, putting personal anecdotes and sticking them on this board and just seeing the scale and breadth, you know, from what would be, you know, the full spectrum of, you know, bad, poor behavior and criminal behavior in some cases, where it was just, it is quite shocking, I think, how much goes on. I think it's a bit like, you get a similar thing with race, where if you're not, you know, as a man, as a white man, you know, you're not, when you're not having direct experience of these things, you sometimes your awareness of them isn't, they aren't necessarily on your radar in the way that they are for people who are open to prejudice or sexual harassment or whatever else. And it can be quite shocking to understand the full scale of what actually goes on for people in the industry.
And when you hear the testimonies of people who've, I mean, a lot of people aren't quite sure that what they've experienced is sexual harassment. They're saying, you know, I didn't like that very much and it made me feel crap. But was that sexual harassment? And also people are very worried about that if they do complain formally, that A, they will not be treated well at their company, that people are fearful about how management protects the harasser, and often people find themselves being shown the door or being asked to sign a some sort of, you know, non-disclosure agreement and given money to disappear, or they worry about the harasser's family. You know, wouldn't it be awful if their family? So a lot of people don't complain, and it's really important that you encourage people to make the complaint. Not that anything necessarily terribly is going to happen to the harasser, but for their own education, they will feel better themselves if they stop this behaviour. It can be, you've got to speak up. If you witness it, things I didn't do, I didn't speak up in the 80s. I wish I had. You know, even something saying, you know, your ass looks great in that, or people just squeezing people's tits, whatever it is, you know, you think, oh, that's quite innocent. It's just banter. But, you know, if you read what people say about it, they'll say, well, I'm now worried that I only got a job because people thought I looked hot. So it's a great way to make people feel rubbish at their job.
But what advice would you give to women coming through? I think you're one of those people where your strength comes through quite strongly. Your authority comes through quite strongly. When you're on stage, you have a presence. What advice would you give to women coming up through the ranks that to get to your point?
Well, I think there's lots of advice. First of all, join a network. So I'm an ex-president of WACL. WACL does a huge amount to help women, not just so, although it's a group of senior women, they do more and more. They have training sessions, they have bursaries. When I was president, we set up something called the Future Leaders Fund. It's now called the Talent Fund, where WACL actually gives people money, women money, to go and train in middle and senior management courses, because when it was set up, women were not getting training budgets. But there are other things like Bloom and Dawn, other great organisations that will help women feel better together. I think increasingly younger women are less prepared to sit back and wait to be invited to take on a senior role. They're much more self-confident, but not completely. And one thing I have this thing I call the three P's that women should try and get better at. One is PR. Women are generally not terribly good at blowing their own trumpet. And they shouldn't be ashamed. I mean, I was not great at it. And then I got a lot better at it. So there's no point doing some brilliant work and then letting some bloke take the credit at the end of the day. Take the credit that's due to you. So PR is the first one. The second one is politics. Politics is one of those words that people are scared of. And they really shouldn't be. What they tend to mean when they hear the word politics, what they hear is some nasty Machiavellian bastard who's trying to weasel their way around the back of you to talk to the boss. That's only one aspect of politics. We call those either the wily foxes or the stupid donkeys. Politics is just about understanding how your organization works, how decisions get made, how you can influence it. So in politics, don't be an innocent sheep. That's the third animal. And often women are innocent sheep. They just say, oh, I just get on and do my job and I keep my head down and I don't get involved. And that's, you end up being eaten. It's what happens to innocent sheep. You need to be a wise owl. You need to watch and understand and try and get things to change in your company on behalf of everybody else. Politics isn't just about selfish manipulation. It's absolutely about how can I influence this organization in a good way for everybody's benefit. So don't abandon politics. Politics are the way organizations function, and you need to understand it, and you need to be one of the influencers, and why not? And the last P, I suppose, is power. This makes me sound like a fucking maniac, doesn't it? But power is one of those things that you have to, in the end, want to wield. Because without power, it's hard to make things happen. And I want more women to want power, because being powerful is better than being powerless. It's pretty miserable being powerless. You see something that's wrong and you can't do much to change it. So they're my three P's, I suppose, that I would say to women.
I think that's, yeah, outstanding answer. So I know you aren't fully retiring, but so what are your plans for when you do?
Well, I suppose in a way, I've just had a 43-year gap in what I probably always wanted to do, which was write things. So I did an English degree, and then I went to drama school and I wrote plays in theatre education. So I've, as well as being able to spend a lot more time in my garden, so I am an absolutely passionate gardener and quite competitive. So there's a bit of silverware in a cupboard over there from village shows showing unusually shaped vegetables. It's one of my specialities. Obscene carrots are very big.
It's a specialty.
So I do a lot of gardening and I completely love it. And I find it, you know, I'm not somebody who any longer has any religion, but I find gardens and music, classical music, I suppose you'd call it, the nearest thing I'm ever going to get to heaven. But also I started writing trashy romantic novels about 4 years ago. And two of them have been published. And so I would urge anybody watching this, please go and buy my lovely romantic novels. The first ones I'm writing, is the first one, it's a trilogy. So I'm just finishing the third in the trilogy. And they have to be set in Ireland.
I know. I've bought one. I told you I still haven't got around to it, but I will.
I have an Irish passport. I had an Irish mother and I got a wonderful Irish family who keep me on the straight and narrow. They advised me that there was no mass on Good Friday. That was one of my first cock-ups. They sorted me out on that score. But I love to write, and I love to write for its own sake. Although I have published these three books, and I hope to publish more, but I would write for the pleasure of it. In the way people paint for their own pleasure or play music for their own pleasure, it doesn't have to be for the public. It's just lovely to create a world that you can then go and live in for a while.
Well, Tess, it's a slight shame that we're not doing this at King's Place, because I know that there'll be a massive roar and a huge round of applause for you and everything that you've achieved at Thinkbox. But thanks so much for taking the time to do this online.
My great pleasure, Vinny.
Cheers.